the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 144 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Never Bet the Devil Your Head by Edgar Allan Poe, as presented by the CBS Radio Workshop. I'm your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Redmond, Oregon. Now, it's been a while since I've introduced an episode of the Journey Into podcast this way, that I am presenting an actual journey. It's been over a year and a half. And as this is the month of October, and at various times on this podcast, I have done an Edgar Allan Poe month, I wanted to bring you this story by Edgar Allan Poe, again, as presented by the CBS Radio Workshop. And they do a pretty good job of presenting this. They do the right amount of paraphrasing and presenting it in a way that can be followed easily by a listening audience. And I think make it pretty enjoyable as well. But today, like I said, we're going to talk about Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And this is an interesting story. It's a little bit humorous because this is a response to Edgar Allan Poe to his critics, who often said that his fiction lacked any morals or any things that people could learn from. And you'll hear some of that in this production. But to be honest, you know, that's kind of one of Poe's pet peeves, is that he feels that just writing a story or a poem, we'll get into that here in a little bit, just for the story's sake or the poem's sake, is of value. It doesn't have to be teaching some great truth or a moral, that it can just be something that people enjoy and it excites their senses or just provides entertainment, that does have value. Anything that evokes some kind of an emotion from your audience is worth telling the tale or is worth writing the poem. And a lot of this comes from an essay that Poe wrote called The Poetic Principle. And so I'll quote a little bit of that. But, you know, a lot of this comes from, you know, we think of Poe as this writer. But he was in his time, he was most known as a magazine editor, as a critic of fiction and poetry and other people's writings. Because he was always involved in different magazines. You know, I think there's several here that I'll list off. I mean, he was an editor or assistant editor in some regards to the Southern Literary Messenger, to Burton's Gentleman's Magazine, to Graham's Magazine, to the Evening Mirror, and the Broadway Journal. And I think I read that toward the end, he was the sole owner of the Broadway Journal. And he had promoted a new magazine periodical, I guess you'd call it at the time, that he was going to call The Stylus, or other reports say it was going to be called The Pen, because he was in Pennsylvania at the time. And yeah, so again, he was known a lot. He did produce his own fiction in these magazines. He did, you know, put together some short story collections and some poetic collections as well, and sold them outright. But he sold stories to other magazines and presented them in these magazines that he was an editor of. But he also critiqued other people's fiction. And he was known as the Hatchet Man. because he didn't hold back on his opinions and his critiques of what fiction should be and or what poetry should be. And he was quite against Longfellow. He even accused him of plagiarism. And he didn't like the didactic tone of a lot of his poems. And so let me get into that a little bit. And I'm sorry this is going a little bit long before I present the story, but I think it'll apply to it. And you'll kind of see what this story is kind of a satire of, or what he's making a satirical comment about. And I'll probably skip around a little bit. I won't read this word for word, but I'll read a little bit here. So again, this is from The Poetic Principle, which was published posthumously. It was kind of his theory about what makes a good poem and what he didn't like. And I think this would apply to what he thought of fiction as well. And so when I read poem, I think it applies to all of his literary works. But he says, to quote him, he says, "It has been assumed that the ultimate object of all poetry is truth, capitalized. Every poem, it is said, should inculcate a moral. And by this moral is the poetic merit of the work to be adjudged. We Americans especially have patronized this happy idea, and we Bostonians very especially have developed it in full. We have taken it into our heads that to write a poem simply for the poem's sake, and to acknowledge such to have been our design, would be to confess ourselves radically wanting in the true poetic dignity and force." And later on, it's kind of interesting. He divides the mind into three distinctions. He says there on either end, there's pure intellect, and there's what he calls the moral sense. And then in between, as the mediator, he puts taste. So you have intellect on one side, moral sense on the other, and in the middle you have taste. Just to quote a little bit of it here, he says, "Just as the intellect concerns itself with truth, so taste informs us of the beautiful, while the moral sense is regardful of duty. Of this latter, while conscience teaches the obligation and reason the expediency, taste contents herself with displaying the charms." In there, he talked about, you know, taste informing us of the beautiful. And he talks a lot after that about the real poetry is seeking after the beauty in things, the beauty in life. And that's what poetry should be about. And in a lot of ways, you know, I think that's what his fiction is about. And maybe beautiful might not be the right term for like The Telltale Heart or Murders on the Roe Morgue. But I think, you know, anything that grabs at your senses as a human being, your fear or your excitement or any of those types of things. So that's probably enough speculating and pontificating about fiction and poetry and things like that. But I just wanted to read a couple of those things so you can see where maybe the inspiration for this story came from. Well, it's probably time to go ahead and start this up. It's been a while. I had to pull the Wamperdime temporal radio tuner out of storage. It's been in the garage for a while. I brought the box in earlier today. So, hold on here. Let me get this on here. Okay, let's see, put the mat down here, and connect these cables, okay, all right, I think we're ready to go. So, without further ado, come with me, and let's journey into the merits of a moral life.
deep, but I swam it.
Janet.
The future is ours, so let's plan it.
Janet.
So please, don't tell me to can it.
Janet.
I've one thing to say, and that's damn it. Janet, I love you.
After all, what good is the soul anyway? It's sort of like an appendix these days, particularly since it doesn't exist in the first place.
Well, just for the sake of argument, why do you particularly want mine?
Well, for the sake of argument, let's say I'm something of a connoisseur, and you have a very choice soul, and as the vintners say, it's a good year.
But why?
Because you're my father.
I'm a little more than that, Kevin. Awfully hot in that courtroom, wasn't it? What's the game plan, Kevin? Was a nice run, Kev. Had to close out someday. Nobody wins them all.
What are you?
Oh, I have so many names.
See.
Call me Dad.
Enjoy your lunch, son.
Oh, hi, Pop. This isn't lunch.
So I can see. Candy, wasn't it?
Uh-huh. I was going to give it to my girl for Valentine's.
Instead, you gave it to your stomach.
Well, she doesn't like me anymore. She's got a crush on Butch Christus.
Well, I should think you'd be heartbroken.
Well, I was. For about 5 minutes.
Junior, you have just displayed a perfect illustration of one of my favorite adages. To wit, time heals all wounds.
And now comes the fable, right?
Right.
My name is Poe. Edgar Allan Poe. I write stories. Charges have been brought against me by certain ignoramuses that I have never written a tale with a moral. By way of mitigating these ridiculous accusations, I offer the following unusual history, a history about whose moral there can be no question whatsoever. For you can see the moral in its very title, Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And note, please, that I do not bring in the lesson at the tag end of the fable, as others are wont to do. Very well. Here, then, I denounce my critics and beg no favor other than your close attention.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. The world too long thought of Edgar Allan Poe as a dour misogynist who concerned himself with black cats, gold bugs, pits, pendulums, and murder. Few realize, and fewer would believe, that this man of gloom had a sense of humor. This, the workshop now seeks to prove, in William N. Robeson's production of Edgar Allan Poe's satiric story, Never Bet the Devil Your Head, starring John Daner, with music conducted by Amerigo Marino, and with Jack Johnstone as guest director.
It is not my design to vituperate my deceased friend, Toby Dammit. He was a sad dog, it is true, and a dog's death it was that he died. But he himself was not to blame for his vices. They grew out of a personal defect in his mother. I recall a conversation I had with her when Toby was a mere babe in arms.
Duties to a well-regulated mind, Mr. Poe, are always pleasures. It is my duty, and therefore my pleasure, to see that as quickly as possible my son learns the difference between right and wrong.
But must you flog him so, Mrs. Dammit?
Babies like tough steaks are invariably the better for beating. It drives the evil propensities out.
But my dear woman, you have the misfortune to be left-handed.
I do not consider left-handedness a misfortune.
No, you fail to understand me. Madam, a child flogged left-handedly had better be left unflogged.
And deign to tell me why?
The world revolves from right to left. If each blow in the proper direction drives out an evil propensity, it follows that every thump in an opposite one knocks its quota of wickedness in.
Ha! That is a specious argument that does not warrant a reply, except perhaps this.
I was all too often present at Toby's chastisements, and even by the way he kicked, I could perceive that he was getting worse and worse every day. At last I saw, through tears in my eyes, that there was no hope for the villain at all, and one day when he had been cuffed until he grew black in the face, that no effect had been produced beyond that of making him wriggle himself into a fit, I could stand it no longer, but went down on my knees forthwith, and uplifting my voice, made a prophecy. A prophecy of his ruin. For the fact is that his precocity in vice was awful. At 5 months of age, he got into such passions that he was unable to articulate. At 6 months, I caught him gnawing at a pack of playing cards. At 7 months, he was in the constant habit of catching and kissing female babies. At 8 months, he peremptorily refused to put his signature to the temperance pledge.
No, no, no.
Thus he went on increasing in iniquity month after month, year after year, until in his youth...
Mama, it is my desire to wear mustaches. And furthermore, I'll bet I can grow them. By the bill, book, and candle, by Job's comforter, I'll bet I can.
As you see, he had even contracted a propensity for cursing and swearing, and for backing his assertions with bets. Not that he actually laid wagers. No, I will do my friend the justice to say that he would as soon have laid eggs. With him, the thing was a mere formula, nothing more. You see, he was detestably poor, another vice which the physical deficiency in his mother had entailed upon him. And this was the reason, no doubt, that his expletive expressions about betting seldom took a pecuniary turn. It was usually, I'll bet you what you please, or I'll bet you what you dare, or I'll bet you a trifle, or else, more significantly still, I'll bet the devil my head. At all events, through this most ungentlemanly practice, the ruin which I predicted for Toby Dammit overtook him at last. For indeed, the fashion had grown with his growth and strengthened with his strength, to the point that when he finally came to be a man, he could hardly utter a sentence without interlarding it with a proposition to gamble.
Devil me, Mr. Poe. It is and remains my contention that these United States shall serve as an arrow to the target of liberty. My wager on that, sir. I'll bet you what you please.
Toby, this habit of yours is an immoral one, and I feel constrained to tell you so.
Pish-posh, Mr. Poe.
It is vulgar. I beg you to believe me.
Twaddle.
It is discountenanced by society. I say nothing but the truth.
Tush!
Gambling has been forbidden by an act of Congress. I entreat you, I implore you.
Utter foolishness.
Then, by heaven, I shall have to knock some sense into you.
That, sir, was a dastardly thing to do. Should you venture to try such an experiment again, I shall necessarily return in kind, and you will rue the result. I'll bet the devil my head you will.
Yes, there it was again. The quintessence of his abominable expressions. I'll bet the devil my head. But there was nothing more I could do. I quit the scene in desperation and in sorrow. However, I could not evade the fact that Mr. Toby Dammit's soul was in a perilous state. I resolved to bring all my eloquence into play to save it. I vowed to serve him as St. Patrick, in the Irish Chronicle, is said to have served the toad. That is to say, awaken him to a sense of his situation. So, I addressed myself to the task. I remonstrated with him, but to no purpose. I demonstrated in vain. I entreated. He smiled. I implored. He laughed. I preached. He sneered. I threatened. He swore. I pulled his nose. He blew it. And once again,
I'll bet the devil in my head that taught you a lesson.
Toby, have you considered the gross impropriety of a man betting his brains like banknotes?
Should I?
You have adopted this mode of wager, I'll bet the devil my head, with a pertinacity and exclusiveness of devotion that displeases me no less than it surprises me. Now, the truth is...
I'll bet the devil my head I'm going to get another lecture from you.
The truth is, there is something in the air with which you are wont to give utterance to this offensive expression, something in your manner of enunciation which, for want of a more definite term, I must be permitted to call queer.
Oh?
It is your soul I am considering, Toby. Otherwise, you must believe this. I would not be speaking to you of these matters when I am so aware of your distaste for them. For some moments, he remained silent, merely looking me inquisitively in the face, but... presently, he threw his head to one side and elevated his eyebrows to a great extent. Then he spread out the palms of his hands and shrugged up his shoulders. Then he winked with the right eye. He repeated the operation with the left. Then he shut them both up very tight. Then he opened them both so very wide that I became seriously alarmed for the consequences. And applying his thumb to his nose, he made a disgusting, indescribable movement with the rest of his fingers. Finally, setting his arms akimbo, he condescended to reply.
Mr. Poe, I will be obliged to you if you would hold your tongue. I wish none of your advice. I despise your insinuations, equivocations, adumbrations. In short, sir, your entire peroration. I am of sufficient age to take care of myself. Or is it your misconception to consider me still an infant? Sir, do you mean to impugn my character? Is it your intention to insult me? Are you a fool, sir? Tell me, is your maternal parent aware of your absence from the domiciliary residence?
I beg you.
I put this question to you as a man of veracity, and I will bind myself to abide by your reply. I demand once more, does your mother know you're out? Your confusion betrays you. I'll bet the devil my head she does not. And so I bid you, Mr. Poe, good day.
He left my presence in quite undignified haste. It were well for him that he did so. My anger had been aroused. For once, I would have taken him up on his insulting wager, bet the devil my head indeed. And I would have won for Satan, Mr. Dammit's little head, because, you see, the fact is, my whereabouts was known by my mother. Ah, well... it was in the pursuance of my duty that I had been insulted, so I bore the insult like a man. And it now seemed to me that I had done all that could be required of me in the case of this miserable individual. I resolved to trouble him no longer with my counsel, but to leave him to his conscience and himself. But I must confess that although I forbore to intrude with my advice, I could not quite bring myself to give up his society altogether. Worse, I even went so far as to humor some of his less reprehensible propensities, and there were times when I found myself lauding his wicked jokes, but with tears in my eyes, so profoundly did it grieve me to hear his evil talk.
Oh, by the great horned toad, Mr. Poe, your aptitude for companionship, without censure or reprimand, has taken a turn for the better. It puts me in mind of the gentleman from New York, Mr. Greeley, who importuned a man of tender years to seek the western shores, remember? Yet, to my knowledge, he never made the trek himself. Oh, yes. Unsought advice is like a woman left waiting at the church. Uncalled for.
Well, perhaps...
Zounds and hellions, sir. I'll bet the devil my head if you cannot agree on that.
Well... all right, Toby. Toby, what's to become of you?
Oh, your concern is, touching, Mr. Poe. But it smacks of your former attitude, and I shall have none of it. None, I say. Come, it's too fine a day to spend it on peradventure and mayhap pursuits. Let us stroll the roadside in the country lane, commune with nature in her pristine glory, seek the unfettered pleasures of the here and the now. Well, sir?
Very well, Toby. Thus it was that we strolled out together, arm in arm, our route leading us in the direction of a river.
Ah, there, Mr. Poe. You see? Beyond the stream, that field of fluorescence. Would not the Roman goddess herself exclaim over its perfection?
It is beautiful.
Beautiful? By the sons of Saul, your words make a beggary of faultless grandeur. My friend, your jaundiced eye requires closer appraisal, and your stopped-up nose a clearer whiff.
But it's only a field of trees and flowers. I can see it very well from here.
Stuff and nonsense. If you possessed a whit of perspicacity, that same jaundiced eye would indicate a covered bridge within a stone's throw. We shall cross it, go beyond it, and wander lonely as a cloud, to steal a phrase from one of the English greats. Come now.
The bridge was roofed over by way of protection from the weather, and the archway, having but few windows, was thus uncomfortably dark and echoed resoundingly. As we entered the passage, the contrast between the external glare and the interior gloom struck heavily upon my spirits. Not so upon those of the happy dammit who offered to bet the devil his head that I was hipped. He seemed to be in unusual good humor. He was excessively lively, so much so that I entertained I know not what of uneasy suspicion. A certain species of austere Merry Andrewism seemed to beset my friend and caused him to make quite a tomfool of himself.
Edgar Allan Poe!
Up here! On the railing! I'm a bird! I fly!
Whee! Nothing would serve him but wriggling and skipping about under and over everything that came in his way, now shouting out and now lisping out all manner of odd little and big words. I really could not make up my mind whether to kick him or to pity him.
Antediluvian Transcendentalism! Whee! Anti-disestablishmentarianism!
At length, having passed nearly across the bridge, we approached the termination of the footway when our progress was impeded by a turnstile of some height. Through this, I made my way quietly, but this turn would not serve the turn of Mr. Dammit.
Hold. This mechanism, Mr. Poe. Are we cattle to be impeded in this manner?
It's merely a turnstile. I pass through it without
it's
any...
It's merely a turnstile. While me, I defy it.
How can you defy an inanimate object?
By leaping over it. Not only shall I leap over it, but I shall perform a buck and wing at the apex of my jump.
Oh, but Toby, it's nearly 5 feet in height.
A bagatelle.
Ah, you're a braggadocio. You cannot do it, and you know you can't.
No? I'll bet the devil my head I can. You hear me? I'll bet the devil my head.
I was about to reply, notwithstanding my previous resolution, with some remonstrance against his impiety, when suddenly I heard, close at my elbow, a slight cough, which sounded very much like the ejaculation...
A hymn.
I started and looked about me in surprise. My glance, at length, fell into a nook in the framework of the bridge, and there upon the figure of a little old gentleman of, shall we say, venerable aspect, yes, and of reverend appearance, for he not only had on a full suit of black, but his shirt was perfectly clean, and the collar turned very neatly down over a white cravat, while his hair was parted in front like a girl's. His hands were clasped pensively together over his stomach, and his two eyes were carefully rolled up into the top of his head. Upon observing him more closely, I perceived that he wore a black silk apron over his small clothes, and this was a thing which I thought very odd. Before I had time to make any remark, however, upon so singular a circumstance, he interrupted me. To this second observation, I was not immediately prepared to reply. The fact is, remarks of this laconic nature are nearly unanswerable. I am not ashamed to say, therefore, that I turned to Mr. Toby Dammit for assistance. Dammit, what are you about? Don't you hear? The gentleman says, ahem. I looked sternly at my friend while I thus addressed him, for, to say the truth, I felt particularly puzzled. And when a man is particularly puzzled, he must knit his brows and look savage, else he looks like a fool. Toby! Dammit! Although this sounded very much like an oath, believe me, nothing was further from my thoughts. Dammit! The gentleman says, ahem! I do not attempt to defend my remark on the score of profundity. I did not think it profound myself, but I have noticed that the effect of our speeches is not always proportionate to their importance in our own eyes. But if I had knocked Toby on the head with the turnstile itself, he could hardly have been more discomfited than when I addressed him with those simple words.
You don't say so. Are you quite sure he said that? Well, at all events, I'm for it now, and may as well put a bold face upon the matter. Here goes, then.
Strangely, the little old gentleman seemed pleased. God only knows why. He left his station at the nook of the bridge, came forward with a gracious air, took Dammit by the hand, and shook it cordially, looking all the while straight up in his face with an air of the most unadulterated benignity it is possible for the mind of man to imagine. Finally, he spoke.
Well, well, Toby Dammit.
That's right, good sir. And what think you of my assertion and my wager?
That you can leap the turnstile?
Correct you are, and perform with consummate skill a buck and wing at the apex of my leap.
I am quite sure you will win your wager, Dammit, but we are obliged to have a trial, you know, for the sake of mere form.
Ahem. A trial, you say? Ahem.
My friend took off his coat with a deep sigh and tied a pocket handkerchief around his waist. He produced an unaccountable alteration in his countenance by twisting up his eyes and bringing down the corners of his mouth. I did not express myself aloud, but I thought this is quite a remarkable silence on the part of Toby, Dammit, and is no doubt a consequence of his verbosity upon a previous occasion. I wonder if he has forgotten the many unanswerable questions which he propounded to me so fluently on the day when I gave him my last lecture.
Ahem!
The old gentleman now took him by the arm and led him more into the shade of the bridge, a few paces back from the turnstile.
My good fellow, I make it a point of conscience to allow you this much run. Wait here till I take my place by the stile, so that I may see whether you go over it handsomely and don't omit any flourishes of the buck and wing. A mere form, you know. I will say, one, two, three, and away! And mind you start at the word away.
The little gentleman stood there a moment, looking quietly at Toby as though appraising him. Then he turned, walked away, and took his position by the stile. Again he paused a moment, as if in profound reflection, then looked up and smiled very slightly, tightened the strings of his apron, and took a long, long look at Dammit. I thought to myself, what right has the old gentleman to make any other gentleman jump? Who is he? If he asks me to jump, I won't do it, and that's flat, and I don't care who the devil he is. The devil he... But what I said, or what I thought, or what I heard, occupied only an instant. The black-suited little man gave the word as agreed upon.
One, two, three, and away!
I saw Toby run nimbly and spring grandly from the floor of the bridge, cutting the most awful flourishes with his legs as he went up. I saw him high in the air, buck and winging it to admiration. I thought it a singular thing that he did not continue to go over, but the whole leap was the affair of a moment. And before I had a chance to make any profound reflection, down came Mr. Dammit on the flat of his back, on the same side of the stile from which he had started. At the same instant, I saw the old gentleman running off at the top of his speed. But ere leaving us, he had caught and wrapped up in his apron something that fell heavily into it from the darkness of the arch just over the turnstile. At all this, I was much astonished, but I had no leisure to think, for Mr. Dammit lay particularly still, and I concluded that his feelings had been hurt and that he stood in need of my assistance. I hurried up to him and found that he had received what might be termed a serious injury. Quite serious. Quickly, I threw open an adjacent window of the bridge, and the sad truth flashed upon me. About 5 feet above the top of the turnstile, there extended a flat iron bar that served to strengthen the structure. With the edge of this brace, it appeared evident, the neck of my unfortunate friend had come precisely in contact. And alas, the truth is, he had been deprived of his head. He did not long survive his terrible loss. Despite the efforts of the physicians, he grew worse and, at length, died. So I bedewed his grave with my tears, worked a bar sinister on his family escutcheon, and assumed the general expenses of his modest funeral. Exit Toby Dammit. Toby Dammit, a lesson to all riotous livers, and proof absolute of my initial assertion that every tale should have, must have, does have, a moral.
You have just heard John Daner in the CBS Radio Workshop's production of Never Bet the Devil Your Head, under the guest direction of Jack Johnstone. It was adapted for radio by Alan Botzer, with music composed and conducted by Amerigo Marino. Heard in the supporting cast were Eleanor Audley, Leon Ledoux, Dawes Butler, Richard Beals, and Howard McNear. Next week, from New York, the workshop will present The Heart of Man, a dramatization of a surgical operation in which the heart itself is the principal actor. Hugh Douglas speaking. This is the CBS Radio Network.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed the moral tale of never bet the devil your head. pretty much a literal moral that comes from that. Again, I really enjoy that as a humorous piece, as kind of a commentary or a satire by Edgar Allan Poe. And I like the way that it was presented. You know, it was lighthearted. It wasn't the typical, you know, when you hear of Edgar Allan Poe, you think of the macabre and the, you know, the horrific things, which I've definitely presented and enjoy. But this was done, and I don't know if you recognize some of the voices there toward the end. They just kind of ran through those, who the voice actors were at the end. But Dawes Butler was the voice of Toby Dammit. And as I was listening to that, I'm like, boy, that sounds like something really familiar. But I couldn't quite put my thumb on it. And then I looked up Dawes Butler, or I looked up all the different voice actors, and Dawes Butler showed up, and duh, I should have remembered who Dawes Butler was. He's pretty much the entire cast of any Hanna-Barbera cartoon from back in the day. You know, you have Mel Blanc, who did all the Looney Tunes characters, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, all those. Well, Dawes Butler was that person for Hanna-Barbera. He was Yogi Bear. He was Snagglepuss. He was Quickdraw McGraw, Huckleberry Hound. He was the voice of Elroy Jetson from the Jetsons, Dixie Mouse from Pixie and Dixie. He was actually the voice of Captain Crunch. And again, just several Hanna-Barbera characters. But the one I think that his voice for Toby Dammit reminded me the most is Aesop's son in the Aesop's Fables from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. And again, these are old cartoons, right? I mean, these were back in the 60s, maybe even the 50s. I don't know. Before my day, before I was born. But of course, growing up, I watched all the reruns. I thought that was interesting, and I did definitely recognize that voice from that. And so I hope you enjoyed this that production. And this was supposed to be part one of two Edgar Allan Poe episodes of Journey Into that I brought to you. I've been working on a full cast production of an Edgar Allan Poe story. And I got a lot of listeners to lend their voices and had really spent a lot of time putting things together. And unfortunately, last month, the hard drive that I was putting all of my audio on, and I was trying to consolidate everything into one place. And in some ways, that's a good idea. In some ways, that's not. In the way that it's not is what bit me. Even though it was a pretty new hard drive, it crashed on me. And just one day, it was one minute it was working just fine. I was doing stuff on it, and the next minute it stopped working. And so I lost my production, everything that I had put together. It was pretty close. I just needed to add a few more sound effects, add a little bit of music in there to pull it all together, and I would have been done. But unfortunately, it's all lost, and I will not be able to pull anything together for the month of October or for several months to come, unfortunately. So that's too bad. I was really looking forward to presenting that because I had gotten a lot of input from listeners of the podcast and people that were interested in voicing something. I still have, I believe I still have all those recordings in my email, and so I could begin again to put that together. But yeah, it's going to take a while. So at least maybe 6 months, maybe another year, I don't know. We'll see how quickly I can pull that back together. It's unfortunate. I was really bummed about that. But I will begin again. I won't let that be lost. I really appreciated the people that participated in that. I like Edgar Allan Poe. I like putting his works out here. And I'm going to continue to produce stories or present stories from Edgar Allan Poe. And, you know, there's only so many. And so at some point I might repeat myself. And some of the ones that I've done with old time radio broadcasts that might not be as good as they could be. You know, I might redo some of those that I've run as old time radio and produce them with a full cast or at least one narrator and really try to bring it home with some of those. Before I go here, I have to mention the Patreon. I'm now extremely pleased to have two patrons that are willing to shell out some cold, hard cash to help support this podcast. It really means a lot. You know, it seems like, yeah, I know there's lots of people with hundreds of patrons and making hundreds of dollars, but really, just that anybody would care enough about this podcast to donate some money to it. Means a lot to me. And the first person to jump on was Rob Broughton. I think that's how you pronounce that. Rob, if that's wrong, let me know. I'll correct it here on the air. But yeah, he was the first one to jump in and donate. And he's in there at the $1 level. And again, honestly, you know, $1 doesn't seem like a lot, but I'd rather have 100 people donating $1 each than only few donors, you know, at a higher level. That means more people are enjoying the podcast, more people are willing to participate and to show their support. But anyway, please, you know, the more the merrier to come in on the $1 level. That'd be fantastic. I appreciate it. But then I do have to mention that Keith Teklitz, who is my second donor to the Patreon, he started out with a $5 pledge. I'm honored and grateful to Keith for that. And, you know, that opens up the Comic Cave or Comics Cave episodes that I'm going to be talking about comic books. I have some ideas for the first couple episodes of the Comics Cave. So Keith Teklitz will get those episodes as well as the Outfield Excursions along with Rob there. So anyway, I just wanted to shout them out and to share my appreciation to them publicly here on the podcast. Of course, I invite others to join us here on the Patreon. I'm really looking forward to interacting more with the audience on the Patreon. And I'm hoping that it's something that can generate some excitement and some good interaction with fans there. So check that out. Check out the patreon.com/journeyinto. Just what you'd expect, probably, if you're used to Patreons out there. So take a look at that. Again, you can call the... If you want to share anything with me here on the podcast, you can email to journeyintopodcast@gmail.com, or you can call the voicemail line at 77JN2107, at JourneyN2 on Facebook and Twitter. But thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, stay safe out there and journey on.
The Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Which means that you're free to share this podcast, however and with whomever you would like, but please don't change the content and don't sell it for money. Or any other commodity for that matter, I guess.